GPS is so pervasive in our lives. And perhaps what we ought to do is start off with just a brief commentary about how pervasive that is, that people might not even really think about it. So, Eric, what are some of the things that are really coming to your mind in terms of just the pervasiveness of it?
Well, almost everyone is aware now that GPS may be in car navigation systems, and they use GPS. They see, you know, can we use your location in a smartphone? What most people probably fail to realize is that the timing element of GPS is universal now because of clock synchronization and because the world is so based on cloud computing and the internet. GPS timing is used for power distribution, bank ATM machines, stock transactions, just about anything where precise timing is needed. They rely on the atomic clock accuracy of GPS.
And obviously here in radio, we depend on it every single second to make sure that everything works well. Richard, is there something that you just could not live without if there wasn't GPS available?
I'd say directions in the automobile when you're visiting a new town, and also the ability to see what hotels and restaurants are nearby.
Okay. Well, Richard, I'd like to ask you, since your dad was one of the key scientists in the development of the GPS system, what was it like just growing up in that atmosphere?
Frankly, I didn't know most of what he was doing. He worked at the Naval Research Lab, and a large part of what he did was classified. On the other hand, there were some nice elements. In 1962, we spent the summer in Santa Barbara. He was involved in a 1960s version of the Strategic Defense Initiative. So we spent the summer a quarter mile from the beach with about 150 other kids of scientists and just had a great time. So there's some perks, and I got to meet some interesting people. Captain Weems, who was one of the pioneers in airplane navigation, who taught Lindbergh how to navigate.
Oh, my.
So I met some interesting people, but I was largely unaware of what he was doing.
So now, as I understand it, both of you were independently working on a history of GPS. So, Richard, or Eric, whichever, how did you two connect?
Well, my daughter, when she started driving, used to get lost a lot. She'd call on the phone and say, "Get out the Atlas. Where am I? How do I get back?" And about 5 years ago, she was wrapping up college or maybe just out of college. That stopped. And one day I said, "Well, how come you don't call getting lost anymore?" And she said, "Oh, I went on eBay and bought a Garmin GPS unit, and now I don't get lost anymore." But it was a comment that she made that just stuck with me. She said, "You know, whoever invented this must be a genius and rich." And later I found myself, I said, who was that? And so my research led me to learn about Roger Easton. And I didn't know where he was or if he was still alive. But I discovered that Richard had written some articles. And so I contacted Richard, hoping to use him as a source for my research to write the book. And when I contacted him, he said, "Oh, we appear to be working on very similar projects."
Okay. So where was, excuse me, so where was your project at that point, Richard?
I had, I'd published about four articles and given two talks on GPS. I had approached David Sobel, author of Longitude, who was very helpful, but basically I hadn't gotten anywhere. I'd tried to contact a couple agents and was continuing to do research, but it's very difficult if you're a writer who has not published a book previously to get someone to accept a proposal for your first book. So I was continuing to do research, interview people, because a lot of the people who worked on GPS are now in their 80s or 90s, and I felt it was important to get that history down while they were still with us. So I'd conducted some interviews, but had no luck at that point getting someone to seriously consider my proposal.
And I'm also curious to hear, you know, how difficult was it just getting this, excuse me, how difficult was it just getting the source material that you needed for your book?
There's a book called The Annotated Bibliography of the Naval Research Lab, which is where my father worked, Contributions to GPS. That was published in June of 2009. That was very helpful, and Eric had found it before he contacted me. Those people had given me some documents. I found others in my parents' room above their garage. Talking to people, they'd give me more information. Some of my contacts at the Air Force provided me with useful information, but it was quite a challenge, and that was even given my contacts. So someone starting out would have a hard time duplicating what we've done.
And Eric, I understand some of those documents were still classified.
No documents that we used were declassified during the time we've worked on this. But one of the most important documents, which details the Timation satellite system that Richard's father was instrumental in creating, that had been classified up until I think 1988, so and has been unknown to a great many people. One of our driving forces in writing the book was to make sort of mainstream readers understand how pervasive and successful GPS has been, but to bring to them information that we really had to ferret out from a lot of different sort of hidden away in technical places. The average person doesn't have the time or ability to go find all of this information and put it together. And we couldn't find a source where that had really been done before and written in a way that the average person could understand it. And we found a tremendous amount of misinformation out there online and in different sources. And I'm sure Richard's been at this longer than I have. And some of those myths that are out there just kind of, they start to bug you after a while. You wish you could correct people's misunderstanding.
It's like take over the Wikipedia page or something.
Right.
Okay. Well, let's just briefly go back to the beginning. This was kind of born along with the space race, but in terms of there was a competition between America and Russia, but there was also a competition between the Army and the Navy for who would get – oh, the Air Force and the Navy for who would actually get to launch something like this.
Richard, yes, do you want to take
that one? My father co-wrote the proposal in 1955 that the Navy ultimately, Naval Research Lab, won over Wernher von Braun and the Army the right to launch the first satellite. And he designed the space tracking system, Minitrack, that was used to track Sputnik, Explorer, and Vanguard. And it's one thing I learned in doing the research was the importance of space tracking in leading people to devise satellite-based navigation systems such as GPS. Researchers at Johns Hopkins tracked Sputnik and later came up with the idea for Transit, the first space-based navigation system. A gentleman at General Electric, Roy Anderson, devised a similar system for NASA in the 1960s, and my dad devised two space tracking systems, Minitrack and then the Naval Space Surveillance System. So the importance of with space tracking systems, you're using ground stations to track satellites. And these individuals realized they could reverse the problem. They could use satellites to give the positions of receivers. And it's when you look at the history, you realize, not completely independently, but three different people or groups used that approach. They tracked Sputnik, and then later they came up with systems such as transit and then GPS to give the positions of receivers.
Okay. Let's jump forward in time a bit. And I've asked Eric if he would read the first three paragraphs of your book. So if you don't mind, we'll go ahead and let him do that right now. And then I've got some questions past that.
Okay. The stolen 2009 Chevrolet Tahoe was pushing 100 miles per hour on a residential street in Visalia, California, by the time Sergeant Randy Lensner and his partner, Officer Robert Gilson, got their police cruiser into position behind it. High-speed chases often end in collisions and always endanger innocent bystanders, so the time, about 3:30 a.m., was in their favor. But on this morning, October 18, 2009, the police had another advantage. Some 12,500 miles overhead, a network of satellites was helping to track the vehicle's exact position, and new technology was in place to eliminate the need for hazardous spike strips or bumping tactics traditionally used in police pursuits. Minutes after a shotgun-wielding assailant forced the Tahoe's owner, Jose Ruiz, and his cousin out of the vehicle, Ruiz reported the theft to police and told them it was equipped with General Motors' OnStar navigation, communication, and security system. A call to OnStar quickly provided police with the location of the vehicle, and when the officers confirmed that they were ready, OnStar call center advisors transmitted a wireless signal to the Tahoe, activating its stolen vehicle slowdown feature. Behind the wheel of the Tahoe, the driver pressed the accelerator harder. To his surprise, the pedal became unresponsive and the SUV's engine gradually slowed to idle speed. He jumped out and ran, but was soon in handcuffs. Roughly 15 minutes after Ruiz reported his vehicle stolen, 21-year-old Albert Roman Romero became the first person caught and charged with carjacking as a direct result of GPS technology.
That's just amazing. And a great start to this book, I have to say. Well, Richard, did your dad ever have any idea that GPS or what he was working on could ever have that kind of civilian use?
They knew from the very beginning that there would be civilian uses. Transit soon was used by surveyors and yachtsmen in particular. But as he said in an interview in 2008, they had no idea how pervasive it would become. And even if they had had an idea, the bean counters wouldn't have believed it. So it was kind of irrelevant. At that time, only the Pentagon was willing to fund GPS. So civilian applications, while important, were not useful in terms of getting the system started.
Well, now, because it's so pervasive, Eric, what would happen if we didn't have GPS today?
Well, we went through a sort of a trial run of that a few years ago when a company called LightSquared wanted to install 40,000 terrestrial antennas all over the country to bring what would amount make the whole country a hotspot. It would bring broadband basically everywhere. When the scientists started studying it, they realized that these signals were so close to the radio spectrum of GPS that GPS would have been disrupted and blocked within miles and miles of these antennas. It could have been devastating. So an industry group hired a consultant to do a study of GPS and its impact on the economy. This study was released in mid-2011, and it concluded that GPS contributed somewhere between $68 billion and $120 billion or so dollars to the economy per year, and that a complete disruption of GPS signals could shave like $96 billion off of the economy, which at that time was about 0.7% of GDP. So, you know, people thinking of GPS in terms of whether they may have used it you know, in their car on their phone to find something on a particular day. They think, oh, maybe I use GPS, you know, once a week or once every 2 weeks. I'm not a big user of it. But in the aggregate, it has a tremendous usage and importance and is now a vital part of the nation's infrastructure that must be maintained by the U.S. government in an era of sequestration.
Wow. So, like roads and bridges and GPS.
And so when you hear people talking about the effects of sequestration on the military, people need to remember that they're dependent on GPS, but GPS is funded and operated and maintained by the military.
Fascinating. Okay. Well, Richard, what's the next step in terms of GPS? Where do you, did you guys kind of envision what the next place is for it?
Well, the Air Force is launching better satellites, the GPS-3. The date for the first one keeps on moving off, but they're also envisioning having a mixture of satellites. Today, the satellites, as new ones are coming on board or are being launched, are all of equal quality, and they're talking about a mixture of expensive and less expensive satellites. GPS is originally envisioned was going to have 24 satellites, 21 in use and 3 spares, and now it's got around 31, and with upgrades, they could have more satellites. But more satellites with better, more powerful signals, and also increased use over time of non-GPS methods of navigating, improved inertial navigation devices that are more difficult or impossible to jam. I know that DARPA is working on other methods. And, of course, GPS between jamming and spoofing, you know, its very importance means that both in military and civilian applications, the cost of jamming GPS is tremendous. So our adversaries, you know, like possibly North Korea, may want to hold us blackmail, and alternatives to GPS, such as enhanced LORAN, are an important way of giving us backups.
Very, very briefly, could you describe how GPS works? Can you describe that briefly?
Chapter 5.
I'm sorry, I couldn't catch the end of what you said.
She said she wants a brief description of how GPS works. Read Chapter 5. That's brief.
That's brief. We could probably just pass that.
Well, as I said before we started, it's inherently a technical subject, and our challenge was to draw people into it in such a way that they wouldn't be overwhelmed by the technicalities as we worked our way through the book. One of the things that I hope we've succeeded at doing is introducing a lot of different complicated subjects in a gradual fashion so that the reader doesn't need to start with any specialized knowledge, but when they finish the book, they'll have a lot of specialized knowledge. But in a nutshell, each satellite acts as an orbiting radio station sending out signals to the Earth. The signals travel at the speed of light. The receivers take signals from different satellites, and because the travel times are different, the microprocessors inside the receivers can account for the different travel times of the signals and plot a position, whether on the ground or airplanes use it too in the air. But that's how it works.
Okay, great. Thank you.
And I could make an analogy. Some of the listeners will have read David Sobel's Longitude, which talks about the 18th century challenge of determining a mariner, in particular's longitude. There were two major solutions posited. One was John Harrison, who built the accurate clocks, which eventually became the marine chronometer, and the other were the astronomers taking observations of the moon or the moons of Jupiter. And GPS combines those two solutions. It puts the accurate clocks in man-made celestial objects, satellites.
Are there any topics that you really wanted to talk about today that we haven't touched on?
I don't think so. I think in 5 minutes,
I've got plenty.
There's a danger about talking about too much.
Yeah, we've been talking 22 minutes. So you've got to cut out three quarters of this.
Yeah.
But, well, we didn't talk about the current brouhaha over the NSA. And one thing Richard and I, we chuckle about and think that people ought to know is that, and we touched on this, GPS as a system sends a one-way signal. I mean, it's passive. As many people can listen to it, can use their receivers, just like a radio station. But GPS does not, in and of itself, track anybody. Once a receiver has used the GPS signals to calculate a position, other technology, other wireless technology, can be used to record and send that locational information elsewhere so that somebody can do tracking. People may, I've run into a few people who seem to think that the so-called spying that is done today is part of some grand long-run conspiracy, you know, create GPS, put it in everybody's phone, and be able to track everybody in the whole society. It was not nearly well planned out that way. It's sort of a lot of different things came together, sort of happenstance, to make that possible. But people should realize that if they're using a smartphone, their geolocation information is known to the phone companies, and law enforcement agencies at all levels make more than 1 million requests every year to phone companies for that information. So if you intend to go out and commit a crime, you should not take your phone with you.
Well, this is great. Thank you both.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.